This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In this Radio EcoShock show, we'll find out why factory farms are wrecking the health of millions. Then on to the second largest cause of climate warming, and no, it's not methane. I'm Alex Smith. Let's get going. When young people want local food, safe food, grown organically, when they spend a few cents more for eggs from a free-range chicken, they may not realize they have a long-term champion for all of that and more. John Eichard was raised on a Missouri farm before going all the way to his doctorate in agricultural economics. He's worked in the big farm system and taught at the University of Georgia, the University of Missouri, and more. Since retiring as Professor Emeritus of Agricultural and Applied Economics, John didn't go quiet. He's written a half dozen books and continues to speak in America and abroad. John Eichard, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here. Looking forward to visiting with your listeners.
Well, yes, you have so many good things for our listeners, it's hard to know where to start. Let's begin with a case study of big agriculture gone wrong, I think, in Missouri. Why did you strongly oppose the Right to Farm Amendment in that state?
Well, there were several reasons, but one, I don't think we needed an amendment because farmers already have a right to farm, and there's right to farm legislation in virtually every state. And then the primary reason was that I think the amendment was simply meant to provide protection for the large-scale, what I call industrial agricultural systems today. And there's growing public resistance and concern about the integrity of our industrial food system. And I think the intent of this amendment was to stem or prevent the growing public concern from resulting in any further regulations of agriculture.
And we keep animals and birds in tiny cages. Sometimes they can't walk. Sometimes they never see the sky. How did we come to accept making domesticated animals our prisoners?
Well, I think it's driven by economics, just as the industrialization of agriculture was driven by the quest for ever greater economic efficiency. I think the motivation for that was good to begin with, and in fact, I supported that industrialization of agriculture through basically the first half of my 30-year academic career because I thought we were going to make good food affordable for everyone by making agriculture more efficient and making food cheaper, just making it more accessible to more people. The system that we chose to make agriculture more efficient was what I refer to as kind of the industrial approach or industrial paradigm. It's specialization, standardization, consolidation of control. You specialize in doing fewer things so you can do them more efficiently, you know, like you do in factories. And then you have to standardize those specialized processes just like the different stages on an assembly line. And once you've specialized and standardized, then you consolidate into larger and larger farming operations. So when you mention the animal operations that we have today, these are basically animal factories. They're set up like biological assembly lines where the beef and the animals, the chickens, the hogs, whatever, kind of come into these operations and they're fed and watered and taken care of if they were moving through an assembly line, and then they produce the product at the other end. And while it may be efficient in terms of economic efficiency, it basically treats those animals as if they were simply cogs in the machine or raw materials running through a factory. So when they focus on the economics, there's little room for concern about the health or the comfort of the animal. You know, they argue that animals have to be healthy in order to be productive. That's simply not true. We kill these animals at a very early age, and many of them are in a condition where they couldn't live a whole lot longer if they weren't sent to slaughter at the time they're sent. So it's basically just lack of concern for the fact that these animals are living sentient beings rather than just cogs in a machine.
Well, as city people, we're told that we need to have industrial agriculture to feed our big population. Is that the truth?
No, it simply isn't the truth. In fact, you can go back and see that there's no really any indication that we couldn't have produced just as much and fed the people just as well without having these large-scale sort of industrial operations. Basically, what the industrial approach does, it allows you to produce more with fewer people and with less skilled labor, whether you're talking about manufacturing process or talking about an agricultural production process. And what we've done is we have far fewer farmers now, and so they claim the efficiency in terms of, you know, one farmer feeding 50 people or 150 people or whatever, compared, depends on how you calculate the statistics. But what they're simply saying is that we're producing more with fewer farmers, and many of the people that are working in agriculture are less skilled now because they're basically the factory workers in these animal factories are tractor drivers rather than farmers that are actually making decisions on the farm. So the savings has been, you know, certainly not in terms of use of fossil fuel. We're using far more, or hasn't been in terms of efficiency of using capital because it requires more in terms of capital and technology. It's basically just been a process by which we produce the food that we're producing today with far fewer producers and far fewer farmers, which means far less employment in agriculture. But had we continued to develop the technologies that we were developing in the 1930s and 40s, in that period of time of farming, kind of in the pre-industrial or at least the pre-last phase industrial, there's no indication we couldn't have produced just as much food as we're producing today. There might have been some difference in the economic cost of food, but all the studies would indicate that even today, with current technologies, that we can make a transition to a more sustainable, organic-like production system of agriculture, and food costs would probably go up no more than 8 to 12% at the most at the retail level. And we've seen food prices in the U.S., for example, go up by more than that amount as a consequence of the biofuels programs, which put 40% of the U.S. corn crop into ethanol rather than using it to produce food. So it simply is not true, and there's no way that you can logically calculate that we can't feed the people without an industrial agriculture system at a reasonable price.
It's pretty hard to know where our food is coming from. In fact, in many places, we're prevented by law from seeing these secretive massive pig and chicken farms, much less taking pictures. If you try and take pictures in some states or places, you can be labeled a terrorist. So I think we need a more open food system.
Yeah, I would agree. And what happened as we moved toward more and more kind of focus on economics, The thing is about economics and the economic efficiency that comes with it, it comes primarily from being able to carry out impersonal transactions by buying and selling rather than knowing who's producing whatever it is that you want to buy. And that's the advantage of an economic system or an impersonal economic system, but at the same time it separates you from the people that are producing your food or whatever else you're buying to the point where you lose any real firsthand knowledge of where the food comes from and how it's grown and how the animals are treated and how the land's treated and so on. So I think the local food movement that's booming all across the U.S. today, and the organic food movement before that, was really and is really an attempt by consumers to gain some knowledge of where their food comes from. And I think they've increasingly are losing confidence in the industrial food system, including the government that supposedly is regulating that system to ensure them of the quality and the safety and the, kind of the ecological and social integrity in terms of how the food is produced. And so they're increasingly turning to more localized sources of food production so that they can know the farmers, or at least they're in a situation where they could actually visit the farm if they wanted to. And they're ensuring the integrity of the products through this sense of personal connectedness with the farmer, rather than trusting this impersonal economic system or trusting the government regulations that are supposed to kind of control the, or restrain the social and ecological exploitation of that system.
Well, at this point, it appears like we do have lots of food, maybe too much. There's a rash of obesity and diabetes and many diseases unknown when you and I were kids are sweeping the Western world. Do you, John Eicher, do you tie that to these massive health problems to industrial agriculture?
Yes, I think that's one part of it. I'm not denying that there are problems in the rest of the food system, and those are driven by this focus on economics, trying to sell as much product as they can and make as much profit as they can for the rest of the system. But where I differ from some people, I think it begins back at the farm level. And there were scientists in the 1930s and 40s, again, that anticipated this. Professor William Albrecht at the University of Missouri was one that was notable for that. And he says when you turn to focusing simply on the economics, as he knew was coming with the chemical fertilizers and pesticides and things of that nature, he says what you end up with is you will select crops for the maximum yield rather than the quality. And what you end up with in terms of maximum yield is crops that are higher in those nutrients that come from the air, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen. And she says they will be deficient in those nutrients, those essential nutrients that come from the soil, because that'll be the nutrients that limit production, whereas those that come from the air are basically limitless. And if you think about that, what's coming from the air are carbohydrates, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen. And so you end up with crops that are high in carbohydrates, high in sugar, high in calories, and lacking in some of the essential nutrients. That was his hypothesis. And he says what you'll end up doing then is people will end up overeating on the calories. You'll have crops that are too high in calories relative to those essential nutrients, and they'll overeat on the calories in the process of trying to get enough of those limited nutrients that come from the soil. While this certainly hasn't been proven, there hadn't been many people willing to explore that, I think that's certainly a viable hypothesis for what we see today. As we move toward production at higher yields at lower cost, I think there's growing evidence that we've ended up with a food system that's directly related to an epidemic of obesity and the related problems of heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, various forms of cancer and things of this nature are diet-related. So, I would throw it out as a hypothesis again that I think the industry's afraid or really actively discourages people from exploring the hypotheses that people are overweight today because they're basically starving for essential nutrients that have been taken out of the industrial foods. And I'm not dismissing, you know, other things such as lack of exercise and changes in lifestyle, but even some of those may be related to the fact that people simply don't feel good because they're not getting what they should get from their food.
It makes common sense to me what you've just said. This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is agricultural economist and farming advocate John Eichard. Well, in a YouTube video, you put out another fact that stunned me. You said if you've got even 200 cows, you've got as much waste as a city of 10,000 people. There are operations with thousands of cows and tens of thousands of pigs, not only in America or Europe, but in China too. What's the impact of all that waste, and what can we do about it?
Well, I think we have the evidence, again, that shows that we are polluting the streams, the air, and the water with agricultural waste from these operations. And, you know, the facts are there that there are some differences between animal waste from cows or hogs or chickens than from the human waste. In many aspects, they're very similar. And so the waste from these animal operations is basically like taking human sewage and spreading it out on the ground. And so when we talk about the operation you talked about, the cattle operation being equivalent to what the figure you said was 10,000 people, that would be like, having a town or a city of 10,000 people and telling the people you can just, dump your waste, your sewage out of your slop jars or whatever, dump it out in your backyard and let it be washed away with the storm water. We certainly wouldn't allow that for human sewage, but that's what we're doing with these large confinement animal feeding operations. And the problem is that we're treating agricultural factories, what these big operations, as if they were traditional family farms. Now, on traditional kind of family farms, even if you had the same number of animals, they wouldn't all be concentrated in one place. They would be spread out across the land, and they basically would be animals that would be raised on the farms in many cases where the feed was raised. And so the waste goes right back to the fields where the feed is raised and in quantities that are actually less than the crop needs, because if you're taking off the crop, you're taking off some of their nutrients. So in that kind of situation, then you're not over-applying the nutrients. When you concentrate it from thousands of animals in a small space, even though this waste or this sewage has some fertilizer value, it has a relatively low value relative to its bulk or its weight or the cost of transporting it. And so what invariably they do is they spread as much of it as they possibly can get away with as close to the confinement facility as they can, again, for economic reasons. And that's how we end up with the waste that's there. There was a study done in in the late 1990s. I think it was 98 that it came out. And it was a study specifically related to the impact of large-scale confinement animal feeding operations on water quality in the United States. And the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency report, indicated that there were 35,000 miles of streams in 22 states that had been polluted with waste from these confinement animal feeding operations. And the groundwater in 17 different states that was detected that was polluted. And then, you know, the factory farm operations, they will say, well, at least we're doing a better job than the farmers were before us. The animals would run in streams and things of that nature. And so, you know, we've always had it. We'll have more. But the facts show that, for example, in the state of Iowa, there's been a threefold increase, a 300% increase in the number of waterways that are impaired with agricultural waste since the early 2000s. So during this period of time where we've had rapid expansion in large confinement animal feeding operations, as well as the increases in corn production to produce the ethanol that I mentioned previously, we've had a 300% or a threefold increase in impaired waterways in the state of Iowa, which is during a period of time of rapid industrialization of Iowa agriculture. So the facts are there. It's just that, you know, I think there's a conscious attempt to keep the people from knowing, as you hinted at earlier on, to keep the people from knowing what's going on with the industrial food system.
Now, as we've seen in California, the climate can change for years at a time. Why do you say the climate threat may actually boost better farming methods and more food localization?
Well, I think when you have an industrial system, even though the economic efficiency may be there in terms of kind of this industrial process, you end up with a high-risk kind of system. When you end up with a specialized, standardized, consolidated, you end up with a higher-risk situation. And the only way they've been able to offset that risk up to now is through generous government programs that start with subsidies on the crops that are produced, the feed grains that are produced, particularly corn and soybeans, whereas in the U.S. we have various kinds of price supports that we've had over the years that ensured that if you just produce corn or soybeans rather than producing corn, soybeans, hogs, cattle, sheep, various other things, that diversified farming operation reduced the risk, because if you lost money on one enterprise, you'd probably make it on another, and the output of one, like corn, was an input to a hog operation, so that tended to offset the risk. So when they went to specialization, then the government stepped in, basically, and absorbed the risk by saying, if you specialize in corn and we have overproduction, the corn prices are very low, then the government will support your price at a certain level so that you don't lose much money, if you lose money at all. And then more recently, we've gone to the crop insurance, subsidized crop insurance, where the taxpayers pay over half of the total cost of a very generous so-called crop insurance program that not only allows the farmers to insure the yield at a relatively high percentage of their average yield, but also to insure the price or lock in the price. So virtually in many cases, if not most cases, the farmers can lock in a price at planting time or shortly thereafter that guarantees them a profit on as much corn or soybeans as they want to produce. They could produce the whole county if they wanted to, and without taking the risk, and the taxpayers would be picking up half of the cost, you know, of the crop insurance. So we start with then a highly subsidized sort of our feed production system, which subsidizes then the large-scale confinement animal feeding operations by ensuring, you know, the stable price of stable supply of reasonably priced food to go through it. And then there's a whole range of other government programs that allow for tax credits for various things, such as these lagoon or these manure pits for hog operations, for example. The pit itself isn't taxed in property taxes in certain states, certainly not in the state of Iowa. And there's resistance to that, but a whole range of subsidies that make those systems feasible. Now, as we go to get into a climate situation where we're having to do more irrigation for corn and various other things, then the risk is going to go up, and the cost to the taxpayer is going to go up if we have more crop failure, and there may be growing resistance to that. The logical alternative would be to shift to a more sustainable agriculture system, which is more diversified crop and livestock operations, less reliance on irrigation, not trying to grow things in areas of the country, specialize in areas of the country where they're not well suited to the climate. And in a sustainable agriculture, you basically adjust the farming system to the climate and to the soil and to the topography of a particular place. So it's a less risky system inherently. And so my hope is that we move toward climate change and the cost of ensuring these industrial agricultural systems, and the public knowledge of the cost of ensuring these systems will go up. And that'll be a motivation then to move to more sustainable, diverse systems that are naturally more resistant because they're less risky because of the greater diversity in the adaptation of the farming system to the climate and to the topography and to the land, rather than trying to produce things in areas of the country where they simply are not naturally acclimated.
John Eicher, tell us about a couple of your books. What do you write about?
Oh, I write primarily about agriculture and economics, but everything I write about is from the standpoint of sustainability. I think that's sustainability is really the defining question of the 21st century, and it says, how can we meet the needs of the present without diminishing opportunities for those of the future? And it's committed to meeting the needs of all people in the present. It said everybody should have everything they want, but everybody should have everything they need to support a basically active, healthy lifestyle, just in the case of food security, but that's one dimension of it. And so these are the things I write about, and I think there are sustainability issues that are associated with virtually everything we're talking about, certainly everything we talked about today. The problem with industrial agriculture, quite simply, is it's not sustainable. In order to be sustainable, it has to be ecologically sound. You have to take care of the land. It has to be socially responsible. It has to be good for people, not just as consumers, but also as producers and as citizens. And it has to be ecologically sound and socially responsible if it's to be economically viable. Because everything that's of any use to us, including everything of economic value, ultimately comes from the earth, the air, the water, the energy, the soil. That's the only place there is to get anything. And if we go beyond self-sufficiency, then we have to depend upon other people, trading, bartering, to get our needs met, as I say, beyond just meeting our needs ourselves by going out and working, producing our own food and our clothing. So if the economy, then, is to be viable, and the economy simply allows us to make these impersonal kind of transactions or impersonal relationships, but if the economy is to be sustainable, then we have to maintain the productivity of the land and the productivity of the people. Industrial agriculture is not doing any of those things. And as I discovered as I looked deeper, this isn't just a case of agriculture. This is the case of the whole economy and the whole society. We've created an economy and a society that's driven sort of by the economic bottom line, and we're systematically exploiting and extracting the wealth of the land, and systematically exploiting and extracting the wealth and the usefulness from society, or the human resources, as we economists would call it. And we're destroying the long-run viability, not only of agriculture, but of our economy and our society as a whole. So these are the things that I write about. I focus more on agriculture and food systems because these are things that I know more about, and I focus more on the economic dimension and the economic problems. I think, you know, the focus on economic is the primary reason for the lack of sustainability, so that's convenient for me. But I try to then address whatever issues that society seems to be interested in from the perspective of sustainability, the long-run sustainability. I think that's the key question. Ultimately, the answer to that question comes back from realizing that life isn't just about trying to accumulate as much income or earn as much income and accumulate as much wealth as we might. Certainly, we need those material things of life that we can buy in the marketplace with, you know, our economic income or our wealth, but we're also social beings. There's real value in human relationships that go far beyond just the economic value that we receive out of those relationships. We're just social beings, and we need to relate to other people and families and communities, and so it's not really a sacrifice to take care of people and care about community and care about society. And we're also ethical and moral beings. We need a sense of rightness and goodness about what we do, and I think ultimately, sustainability is an ethical decision. You know, I really believe that we owe a debt to those people of the past that created the life and made the quality of life we enjoy today available to us, and that we can only repay that debt by being concerned about the well-being of those of future generations as well as ourselves. And
now, you've just returned from China. Do you have a couple of thoughts you want to share with us about that?
Well, I had good visits with the people at China about a whole range of issues. And as I said to them, I said, you know, the China and India and Africa simply cannot afford to make the same mistakes that we've made in the United States with respect to industrializing our economy, industrializing agriculture. The world cannot assimilate the same level of pollution, for example. We talk about global climate change. We can't, China and India and Africa can't, you know, generate and release the same per capita pollution that we have in the United States and Europe and even Japan without totally destroying the integrity of the natural environment. But the same thing's true of agriculture. You know, we simply can't afford for China and India and those countries to make the same mistakes we've made, industrialize our agriculture and decimating their rural communities. They've got, you know, millions, or I guess billions of people, we might say, that are left in rural areas, and there's no way they can, you know, drive all those people off of the farm and accommodate them into the cities and you know, live through and suffer the destruction that we've had. There's, you know, we were able to do it in this country because we had an abundance of resources and the country was relatively empty. And the world was relatively empty of pollution and relatively abundant in resources at the time we industrialized. That's no longer the case. You know, the world's filling up with pollution and the resources are being depleted and the world is filling up with people. And so we simply have to change. What we're doing now is not sustainable, and it means that China and India and other countries like that don't have the luxury of making the same mistakes that we've made over the last 100 years or so. We need to move toward a sustainable economy and a sustainable society. I worked with a group over the years. This wasn't the particular group that invited me to China this time, but it's called the Institute for Postmodern Development of China, and their movement is trying to get China to do what I've said here, kind of skip over the so-called modern development era, which I would label the industrial era, and move more directly toward a more sustainable approach. They call it an ecological civilization, a civilization that's based on an understanding that we're a part of nature and that human development is really a part of ecological development. And so these are the kind of things that I was talking to people there about, saying, okay, I realize, you know, they still have a need for economic development for many of their people, but they can develop economically in such a way that doesn't destroy their culture and their social values that they've endured, that have helped them hold their civilization together over thousands of years. They don't have to give those up, and they don't have to destroy the natural environment and extract all of their non-renewable resources. And I think there's indications that they're moving toward that and they're learning. And I told them there, I said, I think it'll be easier for you to make the transition in China than it will for us in the United States, because we're so ingrained in this sort of industrial mindset, it's going to be very difficult for us to change, whereas you're just beginning to move into that industrial sort of modernist mindset, and it would be easier for you to say that we simply don't want to follow the ways of the West entirely. We want to pick those things about the Western development, which has been good, and there's been many of those, but we want to avoid the mistakes. That was basically my message.
Well, as we finish up, I've got one last question for you, and it's just so hard to imagine that big corporations from Monsanto to Cargill will ever let the small farmer back in. Is it really possible that this agricultural empire, I would call it, could fall and we'll see the kind of changes you've been talking about?
Yes, I think it's certainly possible. People are always asking me questions similar to that, and typically they say, well, are you optimistic about the future? And I tell them, no, I'm not particularly optimistic, but I'm hopeful. Optimism means that you think, well, it's going to be quick or easy, or that you know that it's going to work. And I tell them, you know, that's not the way I feel, but I know it's possible. I know it's possible to bring about those changes, and that's all you need for hope. And so I'm hopeful of that. The things that give me hope is I have the opportunity to work with a lot of people who are creating this new sustainable local food movement. You know, they may call themselves organic or biodynamic or holistic resource managers or ecological farmers, or they may talk about permaculture or agroecology or natural farming or a whole range of things, but they're all pursuing this idea of farming that takes care of the land, that cares about people, and provides a decent economic living for the farmers. And so that movement is strong and growing. It's probably, in the U.S., it's probably still less than 10%, maybe closer to 7, 8% of the total food production, but it's grown from basically nothing in the past 25 years to what it is now. So that's one thing that gives me hope. I see people out here that are doing it. We talked earlier about, you know, trying to make a living on a small farm. It's certainly not easy. These people are creating a system that nobody really knows how to do. They don't know what it's going to look like in the end, but it's possible. And finally, you know, the thing that gives me the realization or gives me more hope is I tell people one thing good about being old, and I'm turned 75 this year, is that you can remember when things weren't like they are today. You know, when I was growing up in South Missouri, then basically we had a local food system. I suspect almost everything except coffee and tea and bananas and maybe oranges at Christmas time probably came within 50 miles of the place that where I live. You know, we grew a lot of it on the farms, but we also had local flour mills and meat processing plants and canneries and a whole range of things. So it's pretty much a local food system. And we didn't have supermarkets then. You know, you had a grocery store where you take your grocery list in and they'd get the stuff from behind the counter and put it in a bag for you. We didn't have franchise restaurants. They were all locally owned. And basically, we created this industrial food system, by and large, in about a 50-year period of time. And I see the alternative local food system emerging today, and I think it's at least as far or maybe farther along than the industrial food system was whenever I was a kid. And so I know that change happens, and change can happen very quickly. And I'm not underestimating the magnitude or the size of the political power, economic power of the corporations. But I think if people move more and more to the local level and they begin to create these localized food systems that gives them a degree of food sovereignty, then we can see this system change very rapidly. And in the process of putting together local food systems, I think one of the more important things is we're reconnecting people and they're gaining a sort of a common sense of well-being. And that's the way what we have to do to recapture our democracy. And if we can recapture our democracy, then we can regain the political power to control the corporations once again and to ensure that they function in a way that, including the big farming, so-called farming or factory farming operations, to ensure that they function in a way that doesn't degrade the natural resources or the environment, that doesn't exploit local communities and exploit people. And I think once we take away the ability of the corporations to exploit nature and exploit society, then they really won't be able to compete economically with the alternative farming systems that we see developed today. In fact, we have ways of controlling the pollution that we talked about a while ago from large factory farming operations, much like we do treating the human waste that comes from our cities and municipalities. And we have ways of protecting people within the communities from the negative social implications of these operations. But whenever we suggest these measures and forms of government regulations, they say, well, that's not economically feasible. What they're really saying is if you force us into a situation where we can't externalize many of our costs on society and on nature, then we can't compete economically. And I'm saying when we regain our democracy, we gain the ability to say you can't externalize your costs, then all of a sudden the small operations and the community food systems become economically attractive as well as ecologically and socially attractive. And I think that's when the change will really happen in a hurry.
We have been listening to one of the wise voices. John Eichert is Professor Emeritus of Agricultural and Applied Economics at the University of Missouri. Check out his Common Sense books at www.johneichert.com, and that last name is spelled I-K-E-R-D. And find more links for this discussion in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. John, thank you so much for sharing with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to visit and express my views to your listeners today.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Radio EcoShock.
Coming up, the second biggest cause of climate change, driver of half of all Arctic melting, and killer of millions, Jonathan Mingle on Black Carbon. Something is killing millions of people around the world, including in your city, but we don't want to know what it is. And the same something is the second largest global warming substance after carbon dioxide, and few people know that either. We'll investigate with Jonathan Mingle and his new book, Fire and Ice, Soot, Solidarity, and Survival on the Roof of the World. Jonathan, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's very good to be with you.
We have a long way to travel to the Himalayas, so recently brought into the spotlight by the massive earthquake in Nepal. But let's start closer to home. Why did U.S. President Obama make his most recent climate announcement in a hospital?
Well, you know, I think he was trying to highlight the fact that the pollution, much of the same pollution that drives climate change, is also implicated in some serious health problems. And it's not something that's been on our radar screen until relatively recently in terms of public awareness, but a lot of, whether you're looking at smokestacks from industrial sources or tailpipes from vehicles, along with the carbon dioxide coming out of them, in many cases, you have other forms of pollution, particularly particulate pollution. And the one that I've been focused on in researching and in writing the book is black carbon. And black carbon is really just what scientists call these ultrafine particles that are products of incomplete combustion. And the reason we're worried about those is it's those really small particles that can penetrate deep in the lungs and cause a lot of damage to human health. So I think President Obama has wisely started talking more about the immediate health impacts of being exposed to all kinds of pollution, and the fact that, you know, climate change is not just this abstract problem that's happening to people far away or far in the future. The pollution that's driving it is also putting us at risk here and now.
Yes, there was a study that happened in Brooklyn, and it's been followed up, that showed that pollution from cars and factories, all sources, can actually change the DNA of babies in the womb. And that was pretty scary. And yet, people don't seem to demand more action on this. Why do you think that is?
Oh, I think there are a lot of reasons for that. You know, if you look back at the history of clean air advocacy and legislation, you know, usually it's taken some kind of terrible precipitating event like the killer fog in London in the early 1950s that led to Britain's clean air legislation. Or if you go to China right now and you look at, you know, the air quality problems they're dealing with, finally people are starting to say, you know, look, it's hard for me to breathe. It's dangerous for my child to be, you know, out and about in Beijing. Got to do something about this. So it takes these kinds of events, and it happened in New York City in the 60s as well, or look at L.A. in the 70s or Pittsburgh in the 1940s. You know, it reaches a point where it's so bad and so in your face and in your lungs that people get fed up. And I think we're in a moment right now where people are sitting up and paying attention to that in a way that they weren't just a few years ago. If you go to, for instance, New Delhi, where I interviewed a lot of folks for the book, the air quality in a lot of cities in India is really the worst in the world, worse even than in China. But finally, people are saying this is a problem that demands immediate action.
Yeah, it's strange. You discovered one root of this black carbon problem in a faraway mountain valley. Tell us about the location that stars in your new book, Fire and Ice.
So at the narrative heart of the book is the story of this village I've spent a lot of time in the last several years. It's called Kumik, and Kumik is a village of about 45 households in a valley called Zanskar. And this is in a remote part of the northwest Himalaya in north India. And Kumik is on the receiving end of both the climate impacts of black carbon and the health impacts of being exposed to soot pollution. They rely almost entirely on burning dung for heating their homes. And this is a place that gets very cold in the winter. It's 12,000 feet high. It's not a lot of trees grow up there because it's in the rain shadow formed by the Himalaya. So they depend almost entirely on melting snow and ice for irrigating their crops. And they depend largely on solid fuels, so dung and a little bit of wood that they gather for cooking and heating. And so my first encounter in Kumik was in 2008. I was working in Zanskar on passive solar heating designs with some communities, And I discovered that this was a whole village that was in the process of moving because they've been in a terrible drought for the last few decades, and it's just getting worse and worse. You know, it took a while to connect the dots of their slow-motion catastrophe to this larger global issue of black carbon, but it was pretty astonishing when I started looking into it, just the scope of the damage caused by black carbon and juxtaposed with the fact of how little we seem to talk about it.
You know, it's interesting. I talked to an atmospheric scientist who is from India, and he said, well, you know, even my auntie is cooking indoors with very little ventilation and creating this black carbon soot, but she thinks that the food tastes better that way. It's a traditional way to cook. It's going to be difficult to get the people of India to change away from that.
That's exactly right. And people have been trying to do this for decades with relatively little success. You know, there was a government program in the 1980s and 90s in India that tried to bring what they called improved cook stoves to people across the country, especially in rural villages. And it largely failed because, you know, they took an engineering approach to a wicked complex problem that has a lot of cultural factors. And you know, you need to understand how does that woman in the rural village in Uttar Pradesh spend her day and what kind of fuel is she gathering and what kind of foods is she cooking and, you know, what are her preferences for the design of a stove? And that may vary from Uttar Pradesh just next door to in Bihar, the neighboring state. And you really need tailored solutions if you're going to help people embrace cleaner options for cooking. So that's to say either biomass cook stoves that burn wood or animal dung much more cleanly, or alternatives like gas or electric cooking, biogas, and they have to be affordable. So it is a challenging problem, but finally, I think there's some cause for hope on that front because more companies are trying to figure out how to solve it, and there are these enabling mechanisms like the Global Alliance for Clean Cook Stoves, which is really taking a holistic approach.
Well, before we cycle back to India and the Himalayas to see how one village responds, I'd first like to understand a bit more about how black carbon affects climate change. What did you find out about that?
Yeah, black carbon, you know, it's really the scientist's term of art for the stuff in soot that makes soot dark. And so if you're a climate scientist, the reason you care about black carbon is in its name. It's dark. And just think of any dark rock sitting out in the sun. After a while, you come back and touch it, it's going to be warm to the touch. And, you know, that is the main mechanism by which black carbon adds energy to the atmosphere. It absorbs light across the different wavelengths, and it turns it into heat. It re-radiates it as heat. And then a second mechanism is if that black carbon, and again, think of a microscopic little dark rock that gets deposited on snow and ice, so a glacier in the Northwest Himalaya, for example, it is going to reduce the amount of light that snow reflects back to space. And so then that triggers these feedback loops, and it adds energy to that snow and ice, and it accelerates melting. And then there's a third way that black carbon influences climate, and that's through interactions with clouds. And that's where it's a lot more complex, and, you know, scientists are trying to figure out, well, does it reduce the amount of cloud formation or does it increase it? And clouds reflect light to space. So if you sum up those three mechanisms, and there was an exhaustive study a couple of years ago led by Tammy Bond, a scientist at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and a recent MacArthur Fellow for her work on black carbon. And they found that when you add it all up, it is definitely net warming. And in fact, it's the second biggest contributor to climate change, as you mentioned in your intro, after carbon dioxide.
Yes, we had Tammy Bond on Radio EcoShock. We were pleased to hear from her. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest Jonathan Mingle, author of Fire and Ice. Well, you've alluded to something that confuses me and I think confuses some listeners. It seems like air pollution can play both sides of the game. On one hand, it can add another heat-trapping blanket near the surface, but other types of air pollution deflect sunlight back into space, helping cool things. How can we sort out the different ways that this is acting?
Yeah, and it's really important to keep in mind that black carbon is rarely emitted by itself. So usually you think of a campfire that you might be sitting around, and when it's really hot and the flame is leaping, you know, maybe you've got some darker smoke coming out of it. That means there's more black carbon. Flaming combustion produces black carbon. But, you know, maybe then the fire cools down a bit or starts to rain and you get more lighter colored smoke. So out of a wood fire, for instance, you've also got things like organic carbon and sulfates coming out of that smoke. And those are lighter colored particles, and they reflect light when they're up in the atmosphere. So it's not always the case that if you cleaned up that fire, you're going to get a huge benefit in terms of reduced warming. It's true if a lot of those particulates are, in fact, black carbon. So an example would be diesel exhaust or smoke coming out of kerosene lamps, which are used widely in the developing world for lighting because people don't have access to good alternatives. That smoke is almost, kerosene smoke, almost 99% black carbon. But if you look at a wildfire, or if you go to Punjab, where a farmer is burning his rice straw after the harvest to get rid of it, then maybe that smoke has a lot of other stuff in it that might not be directly warming. But at the end of the day, when you talk to the folks who really study this very closely, there's a consensus emerging that even from those fires, biofuel fires, the net signal is warming. It's when you sum up all the stuff coming out of those fires, it's contributing warming.
Now, some people talk about what could happen if we stop burning fossil fuels today. That's usually the phrase used. But if hundreds of millions of people depend on old-style carbon sources for cooking food, even if industrial civilization collapsed or had a big economic crash, this form of pollution would keep on coming.
Well, you know, when you think about the fact, and I'm kind of astonished anew every time I think about it or recite it, that almost 3 billion people around the world still use solid fuels to cook their meals or heat their homes, so dung, wood, coal, and they're burning it in very crude ways. Why are they doing that? You know, if you go into a kitchen in Kumik, you know, I've asked lots of people there if they think the smoke's bad for them. They say, well, yeah, of course it is. But what are we to do? You know, what's our alternative? So the reason people do it is because they don't have access to cleaner alternatives. It costs nothing to go out the door and go gather some dung, some dried dung that you can burn in your stove. So if you're going to try to help that person clean up their kitchen by burning in a cleaner way, it's got to compete with that that zero-cost option. You know, there's a time cost and an energy cost and labor, but you go to the woman in rural Uttar Pradesh, and she's a very sophisticated customer if you're trying to sell her a better stove. So that's one thing to keep in mind. And I think finally we have some stoves that they're not perfect, but they offer promise for that cook who can't spend a lot of her modest income on other fuels. But through smart design and user-centered design, you know, there are stoves now that can burn dung or can burn wood and approach the cleanliness of burning with gas, you know, that blue flame that we're familiar with here in the U.S. if you cook with gas. We've known for a long time how to improve combustion. If you add air, you burn the fire hotter, you mix air with the fuel more effectively, you're going to produce less black carbon. So that's what we need more of. We need more experiments and more kind of smart design for this user who's been neglected for a long time, her needs.
Now, you mentioned that the villagers where you stayed in the Himalayas are likely going to have to move. And this reminds me a little bit about people moving away from California because of the drought there. Do we know why it's getting drier in their valley?
Not, you know, we don't know for sure. And this is one of the challenges when I was writing the book is there isn't a lot of good data in a lot of parts of the Himalayas. It's a remote region. It's tough to do research there. It's dangerous. It's expensive to do field studies of glaciers and how they change over time. There are some studies in Zanskar that suggest most of the glaciers surveyed are in retreat. And we can safely guess, based on the research that has been done, that certainly globally average climate change, carbon dioxide, and other greenhouse gas-driven warming is partly to blame. But the Himalaya and the high Arctic are warming 2 to 3 times as fast as the global average. And so scientists have used to sit around and scratch their heads and say, why is this happening? And we now know with a good degree of confidence, not with certainty, but we never have that in science, that black carbon is responsible for at least half of the observed glacier and snowfield retreat in the Himalayas. And it's probably responsible for half or more of observed warming in the Arctic. It's kind of like, well, how much information do you need to know when to act? And no one has ever climbed the mountain above Kumik and measured black carbon concentrations up there. It'd be great if someone could do that study, but in the absence of that study, or even an epidemiological study saying that the reason infant mortality rates in this village and other villages in Zanskar and Ladakh remain so high, it has something to do with the smoke that they're breathing through the winter and respiratory illness. We don't have 100% certainty, but I think it's safe to say we know enough now to recommend some ambitious, coordinated actions to tackle this pollution.
So, Jonathan Mingle, your book title talks about solidarity. Why?
So, you know, in a way, there were two stories that seemed to me to merit a wider hearing that I encountered, and they're connected. And one is the black carbon story and how it's affecting communities like Kumik, but also communities even in California or New York City and New Delhi. And the other story was the story of this village, and I worked alongside them and gathered their stories over the years, and I was just amazed by how they faced this catastrophe, leaving their 1,000-year-old village, which has been lovingly kind of cultivated down through the generations, and going into the unknown to build a new village from scratch in a pretty hostile, windy, hot, treeless, dusty plain, little to no outside help. And I thought, well, wow, why are they, when they go down there, why are they laughing and singing songs and it feels like a party when we're working there? And I think part of the answer, spoiler alert, if you're going to read the book, is that they have these traditions that are the product of long experience in how to live in a really tough part of the world. They depend on snow melt. They depend on dung for their hearth fires, but they depend on each other is the real answer. And they have sophisticated labor and resource sharing traditions and cultural practices that I think the rest of us could learn a lot from, even as they're slowly disappearing as these communities get more connected to kind of the globalized markets of the world. And that's the solidarity piece. So in a way, I was treating Kumik's story as a microcosm that we can learn from when trying to tackle at this more global scale what seem to be seemingly intractable problems. So climate change, but also, you know, how do you lift the billions who remain in poverty out of poverty without, you know, cooking the climate even more? And I think black carbon sits at the overlapping part of that Venn diagram, climate action, action to alleviate poverty. And I was just inspired by how people in Kumik are kind of rebuilding their lives and some of them embracing solar heating and alternatives to this dirty combustion. And it was just really striking to me how that example of how if you just buckle down and work together, you can get some amazing things done.
It's strange, Jonathan, that most of us have been focused on ice loss in the Arctic and more recently the Antarctic. But now you raise this third pole, as it were, the ice on the world's highest mountains. I know millions of people depend on that water. Is this a problem that's starting now, a water shortage due to melting glaciers, or is it something that is 200 years from now? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, it depends where you are. So you could think of Kumik as kind of on the leading edge of that, the impact of those changes. So in their case, what's happening is less and less snow falls each winter. And, you know, there's natural variability in that, but the trend seems pretty clear. And then spring arrives earlier and earlier. And that means that they run out of water often by August before the harvest. So they can look out their window, see how much snow fell that winter and try to gauge how much they should plant so they don't lose their crops. In other parts of the Himalaya, what people are seeing is, you know, if you go to the eastern Himalaya, it's more of a monsoon-driven snow regime. So those glaciers are replenished in the summertime, whereas the far northwest, like Zanskar, it's in the wintertime. So there are different ways this is playing out across the region. But this trend of warmer winters, earlier springs is pretty common what you hear from talking to people across the region. And the impacts will probably peak much later. So what some scientists forecast is, well, at first you'll have increased runoff, right, as temperatures rise and more of that kind of frozen reservoir gets released. But as it runs off, if you're not able to capture it and use it, it's kind of wasting that storage function. And then, you know, if you go further later into this century, and again, this is kind of our best guesses, nobody knows when the Himalayan glaciers are going to disappear, but, you know, the best current guess is that the peak melting will happen in the latter part of this century. And then after that, you can think of this long tail of increasing dryness. So these rivers that depend seasonally on glacier and snow melt to feed them, so the Ganges, the Yamuna, the Mekong, the Yangtze, the Yellow, they could conceivably, you know, a century from now, be dry for part of the year, or significantly drier.
You just listed what I would call where the majority of the world's people live when you talk about those rivers. You know, it sounds to me as we wrap up here, Jonathan, that you kind of fell in love with this place, that you're maintaining a long-distance marriage or something.
Yeah, that's a very fair description. And the book is in part a love letter to this culture and these people whose lives are changing rapidly. And not just, you know, the environmental changes are pretty striking, but also economic changes are kind of wrapped up with that too. And it's hard to watch. It's hard to watch them leave this beautiful village. And, you know, they probably got sick of me asking them over and over, well, aren't you sad to be leaving this place? And oftentimes they look at me like, you know, what are you, thick? If you don't have water, you have nothing. People would tell me that over and over. And you see it in California today, in parts of California, people realizing the same thing. If you don't have water, well, that's top of your list of worries. So to the extent to which we can maybe learn a little bit from their story, you know, I think they'd be pleased to hear that they function as a model for not just resilience, but also how to get together and have a good time while you're solving problems. That's their credo.
I'm Alex Smith. We've been talking about the links between cooking fire soot, industrial pollution, climate change, and your health, and it's all wrapped together in the new book, Fire and Ice, Soot, Solidarity, and Survival on the Roof of the World. We've been talking with the author, Jonathan Mingle. Find more links to this issue and the book in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Jonathan, thanks for traveling with us today on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's all for this week. Check out all our past programs as free MP3 downloads at our website, ecoshock.org. Find links and more information about today's guest in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much for listening and caring about our world.